Hello, welcome to Ryan Talks Tax, a podcast to keep you up to date on the latest developments in Canadian tax and government funding. I'm Jim Day. In this episode, we're going to talk about the key tax changes announced by British Columbia and Alberta in their 2022 budgets, as well as the current approach to property tax in each province. We're joined today by a couple of returning guests to the podcast. We've got Michelle Pink, a principal and regional leader for Ryan's Canadian property tax practice. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Good. Thank you. And we've got Jeff Shaw, the director of Ryan's Client Support Services Group. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for having me on the podcast today.
Yeah, a hearty welcome back to both of you. And we've also got a new guest to the podcast. We've got Carol Walker, who's a senior manager for Ryan's Sales Tax Advisor Group. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning, Jim. Glad to be part of this group today.
Yeah, good morning to you too. So before we dive right into some of the the measures announced by British Columbia and Alberta, we're well into, provincial budget season. I think we've seen five already. British Columbia and Alberta had the most interesting measures, and we'll talk about those in a couple minutes. But I just want to get your general impressions as to what you guys are seeing so far, or what maybe you expected to see in the provincial budgets. Michelle, maybe we'll start with you.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. So from a property tax perspective, we were probably the least interesting amongst some of the measures that came out of both BC and Alberta. That's coming off a couple of years of turbulence, obviously due to COVID. In previous years, BC, for example, had done a full rollback, about a 25% rollback on their mill rates over the last few years, 2 years ago. And then Alberta had done a deferral program for up to 6 months as a result of COVID. But what we're seeing this year is we're back to status quo as it relates to the provincial budget and what we're seeing for its relation to property taxes. So this year, we're going to see about a 3.7% increase here in Alberta, for example, to the education portion. So the education portion usually makes up a percentage of your property tax bill, but not the full one. So even though the province has announced a 3.7% increase in Alberta, that's just to the education amount. We still have to see what the municipalities say. So in Alberta, since each municipality works on their own property tax mill rates, we're yet to see what that's going to look like. Major municipalities in Alberta will be releasing their own budgets very shortly. I think we're expecting Calgary perhaps by the end of March. Edmonton usually follows a week thereafter. And then some of the smaller municipalities, we'd start seeing the balance of them by about June. So you should know what you're paying, at least in your property taxes, by June. Across most of Alberta, those bills should be going out. So just because we're only seeing a 3.7% increase on the provincial portion of that property tax mill rate, we're not sure what we're going to see from the municipalities yet. But what is really clear in Alberta is that the COVID measures have been repealed, and it does not look like we're going to be seeing anything from that for this year. Same with BC, there are no COVID measures this year. We're expecting the steady increases that we were seeing in the past is what we would anticipate, as well combining that with escalating, I guess you could say, costs and value increases that we're seeing on properties in BC. So when you're marrying those two together, it is going to be a bit of, I imagine, budget shock for some there in BC. But I think that has been pretty clear over the last few years as it relates to property tax and property values in BC. So Vancouver, Lower Mainland, all of those where we do continue to see those escalating values. And then when we're marrying that to a status quo back to normal property tax rates, I think our owners and clients will definitely be feeling that this year in BC in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think that definitely does seem to be a trend. It's like each jurisdiction is kind of hoping maybe the pandemic is over, but they know it might not be, right? So there does seem to be a little bit of caution there. But the focus does seem to be shifting towards, okay, how can we, get our economy back to where it was, you know, before the pandemic. Jeff, what were your impressions? Oh, sorry, Michelle, did you have another comment?
Well, I was just going to say, and that's something that's always interesting as it relates to property tax, because when we're looking at property tax, so valuation is really where your property taxes are coming from, assessment and valuation. And we're always looking back almost a year. So for BC and Alberta, we're looking at values as of July 1st, 2021. So we were still quite in the thick of it, as one would say in COVID. But when these budgets are being done, they are being done almost a full year later from when that valuation period is being done. So there is a bit of push and pull on those two elements. So they don't always marry in this instance. So it is really interesting because we're trying to fight or discuss values that are back in history, but we're looking at budgets at the present time.
Yeah, it's worth noting that Alberta had a balanced budget as well. I think second one in 10 plus years or something like that. So now that has a lot to do with the current price of oil as well, but very interesting. Yeah, Jeff, did you have any general observations?
Yeah, got a couple of budgets out there, British Columbia and Alberta, continuing trend from last year, no major surprises, but just really tinkering. And, from my perspective and a continued focus on trying to prevent tax leakage through marketplaces, you know, these online marketplaces, whether it be for goods or accommodation, and the old standby, you know, let's focus and tax tobacco products, more, and everyone seems to have their sights set on vaping products, so that's the continuing trends in these two budgets.
Yeah, definitely. And we'll talk about a couple of those measures in just a couple of minutes. Carol, did you have any general impressions?
Well, just piggyback on what Jeff said, I totally agree. You can see that the provinces are looking at, where's those tax leakages? And now that everyone is, because of COVID, working remote and the opportunity to purchase and acquire goods outside of a particular province, the provinces are making sure that they're not losing any tax revenues. So they're putting those pieces in place, like similar to all the other provinces have done, and the federal government has done to make sure that, the revenues stay within the jurisdictions that they need them. And as we do see with COVID, again, a lot of lost revenues. Again, we see things changing, the inflation, the gas prices. So each province has got to make sure that they're not losing out. And that's where I see, our provinces, they're working towards. I do see, again, looking at some of the changes as far as emissions and making sure that they're doing their part. So I do give them kudos for that. But on the flip side is, Jeff talked about the vaping product. I'm thinking, we're doing the good on the one side and then they've got something going on the other side. So it's curious to see where they're actually going with a lot of some of the other smaller things like the vaping products and the cigarettes and things like that. But no surprises to me. That was pretty much what I would have expected the provinces to do. So, looking forward to what they're doing next year, it'll probably continue to go forward as well. So.
Yeah, very good observations. I guess we'll talk a little bit about some of the specific measures that have come out. Michelle, you already sort of touched on the education property tax increase in Alberta. Maybe just exactly, what do you think the impact will be to a typical, Ryan client as a taxpayer there?
No, it's a great question. And this is one that we do sometimes in our webinars or our lunch and learns back in the good old days when we were doing lunch and learns in folks' offices. What's important to understand is even if your property tax assessment is the same value year over year, or even if it's gone down a little bit year over year, typically all the way up to a 5% decrease year over year, and you're feeling like, well, we should be good. And therefore, we're just going to be status quo. We're going to look at this next year. What happens is your mill rate will increase. So similar to how, Carol and Jeff and yourself were talking there, we're a revenue like neutral model. At least let's take Calgary for example. Our property tax system is revenue neutral. So it doesn't matter where it's coming from, they will balance that the revenue needed out of the property taxes. And so if the values are decreasing year over year, they're just going to increase the mill rate. So with that increase of mill rate, it can really substantially affect the property taxes that you pay. So even if you're seeing up to like a 5% decrease in your value year over year, you can still be seeing upwards of a 5% increase to your property taxes because your mill rate is shifting. We saw that, for example, out in Edmonton last year. It was a bit of a surprise. The province and the cities do a really good job of saying, well, we're doing a tax freeze. That just means they're doing a budget freeze. In this instance, the values of Edmonton last year went quite a bit down. The budget stayed the same. And so they still needed to fill that gap in terms of a property tax amount. And so we saw that last year in Edmonton, and the mill rate actually increased by almost 10%, which was a really large jump for any municipality in the West here. That's, you know, rather unheard of for a year over year jump. And so I anticipate that we're going to be seeing that a little bit more this year as values have decreased in certain municipalities, and that budget does need to be made up because they're revenue neutral. And so they're trying to fill that gap, as one would say. So even if your values are decreasing, your property taxes likely are not, unless it's a substantial decrease year over year. So that's something to watch out for as well. And in most municipalities, you're going to get your assessment a few months before you get your property tax bill. So they do a good job of separating the two in terms of both provinces. And a few of the smaller municipalities here in Alberta, they'll mail out both your assessment and your property tax bill at the same time. But generally speaking, they're going to mail them out at separate rates. And what's important to know is you can only appeal your assessment. You cannot appeal your taxes. So when people feel okay about their assessed values that they're getting in, they get that property tax bill a few months down the road after, you know, we have our budgets for the province and the municipalities have completed their budgets. At that juncture, it's too late to look at it. It's not something you can challenge or really have a review of. So that's something to be really cognizant as well as we move forward into the year.
Yeah, that's some great insight. You know, on the surface, you look at the budget announcement, it looks like, you know, a very modest little property tax increase, but it sounds like there's a lot more potentially going on there underneath the surface. Staying with Alberta and moving to some of the sales tax measures, and there were quite a few interesting sales tax measures announced by both provinces. But Jeff, it looks like Alberta wants to extend its tourism levy and make sure that it applies to online marketplaces. Do you have a little bit to talk about there?
Yeah, so they're making a change in 2022 to require people that supply short-term rental accommodation. And I think the focus here is mainly on individuals that might be renting their ski chalet or their apartment or even their house, that the accommodation provider is now going to have to collect the tourism levy on the supplies made through their platform. You know, I guess in the past, there's been some of those supplies that probably went through and there was no tax applied to it. And I know, you know, we have a number of hotel and motel clients. They should note that, you know, they can have their properties appear on these platforms as well. And so they may already be collecting the tourism levy when they're supplying accommodation in Alberta. There will be no change to them. They will continue to collect the tax as they have. So they're not going to have to make any systems changes. This is really, I believe, aimed at, you know, the individuals that are renting properties and specifically probably the platforms like Airbnb and Vrbo that may not have been having tourism levy collected on accommodation supplies in Alberta. And I guess it's again an attempt to make sure that they get all the tax that they think they're owed on short-term accommodation supplies in the province.
Yeah, I noticed that measure really didn't have an implementation date as of yet. It looks like more details to come. Is that true? Or
looks like it. There's nothing specific on it. I haven't seen anything yet. So sometime in 2022. That seems to be another trend that you know, I saw in another budget where they announced a couple of changes and absolutely no date, no details. I guess they're just they're still working through it. They're, you know, all the provinces are probably struggling still with COVID measures, and so to pin them down on a specific date might be a little bit challenging.
Yeah. No, I mean, the announcement almost read like a warning. Yeah, this is definitely on the way. We're going to do this. So.
Well, yeah. I was gonna now say, you know. So I operate some short-term rentals there, gentlemen, and I'm on some of the forums, and let me tell you, there everyone is feeling the warning that like the tides have turned, and be prepared. We don't know how to be prepared, but be prepared on that.
Yeah, I guess. I was
going to say the fact that again with the COVID restrictions, a lot of people aren't traveling to the U.S. and they're really traveling across Canada. And I know a lot of friends who have been talking about again being able to see BC and see Alberta for the very first time. You know, it's interesting that the province is probably taking a note of that and saying, "Listen, people are moving around now. You know, I don't want to miss out on that." So they're getting that opportunity to make sure that those who choose to use those Airbnb and Vrbo's are, you know, are getting that tax as opposed to losing out. For that. So that's what I kind of thought was very interesting.
Yeah, no, I think the province also had an interesting approach to taxing vaping. Jeff, what did you think?
Yeah, it's, a couple of years ago, 2019, Alberta announced that they were going to implement a tax on vaping. And, then the pandemic hit and that kind of put the binders on any sort of changes. We saw a number of things deferred during that time, and Alberta deferred that tax on vaping. And then just last year, the federal government announced that they were going to introduce a tax on vaping. And, what I find a little bit unusual is it's not too often that Alberta will agree with the federal government, but in this budget, they've decided that, the better option instead of implementing their own tax and having to create their own bureaucracy and administration to operate the tax, they've said, "Hey, we'll join forces with the federal government, and hopefully that will make life easier for us, and we'll still get the benefits from the tax on vaping." So I think that's an interesting approach, and I think it makes sense. We've seen a number of different provinces say they're going to tax vaping. To me, it makes more sense to have a consolidated effort so that, throughout the country, there's some consistency and, makes as much as taxpayers don't want to pay the tax, at least there's some consistency and they know what they're going to pay throughout the country. I think that makes sense. And it minimizes the bureaucracy and the cost. And so, maybe there's more revenue derived out of this because of that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it does make sense to have, a sort of a federal framework, lots of consistency across the country, much like they have for taxing cannabis, as an example. That said, I mean, this is Alberta. Last time there was a federal framework for something, didn't they challenge it all the way to the Supreme Court of Canada? But yep. I guess they feel a little bit differently about vaping tax versus the carbon tax, I suppose.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the carbon tax is going to hit the bread and butter of Alberta, right? It's going to add more cost and, in theory, less consumption of fuel. I think there seems to be general consensus by almost everyone, except for maybe the people who vape, that vaping isn't good for you. And so I think it makes it easier for them to tag along with the federal government. Plus, I think there's a cost savings to be had here too.
Yeah, for sure. And listen, it's nice to see them working together, right? So I guess following that theme about tackling the whole online marketplace issue, Carol, it looks like British Columbia also introduced some new obligations for marketplace facilitators. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, that was very interesting, Jim. So in the BC budget here, we see that British Columbia now has started as of July the 1st, 2022, to require these online marketplace facilitators to collect the actual provincial sales tax on these taxable goods that are being shipped from within Canada to destinations into British Columbia. So this, again, very similar to some of the other provinces. But what I do find here interesting as well is that at this point, they're targeting those who are shipping from within Canada. I do understand that they're looking into those who will be shipping from outside of the country into British Columbia as well. But again, very interesting. So what you're going to have here is that they're going to require these online market facilitators to collect the tax. Now, the good thing is that the sellers who are selling through these marketplaces are not going to be required to account for the tax. That can be a good or a bad thing. So a good thing is they don't have to account for the tax. But where I'm a little bit concerned is where you've got these sellers who are not only selling through these marketplaces, but also selling through their own direct sales. Now they've got to make sure that their accounting is up to speed, because under audit, to be able to separate what was through the marketplace, confirm that with the auditor, what was not through the marketplace, making sure you're accounting for the tax on that. So that just kind of gives you both a mixed bag of how are we tracking our tax. So I do find that was very interesting. Interestingly enough as well, what you're finding is that BC's also said that where typically sales or services or in BC are not taxable, they're now saying that there's going to be PST on these facilitation services. So I do find that interesting, and kind of just to segue that into what Saskatchewan did. Saskatchewan did a similar thing in their budget recently by requiring the same thing. But what I did find though, Saskatchewan is allowing, for example, any fees that are paid for sales commissions or transaction processing fees, those fees are not taxable. Whereas again, fees that may relate to accessing the actual platform, those would be taxable. But you have here BC saying facilitation services are taxable. I don't see any clear definition as to what they would define as that, but that's gonna be very important as well to take a look at, where we may think that certain things or certain services would not by nature be taxed. We've gotta take a look and make sure they don't fall into the definition of facilitation services, because you're gonna be required to pay the tax on that. And again, what I'm finding too is that when we took a look at Saskatchewan, one of the biggest issues we had in Saskatchewan, a lot of some of our clients that were maybe in the food industry had a real concern with this, which I don't think will be a problem in BC, because BC foods, food items are not subject to tax, but they were more concerned again as to how do we actually balance all that. So clients out there who, for example, maybe dealing in food industry, dealing with Saskatchewan and dealing with British Columbia, need to realize again, there's going to be some changes. I mean, looking at how we manage ourselves, looking at the fact that we may be supplying across Canada. So now you've got to look at all these different pockets. I'm a facilitator, what do I do? Or I'm a seller, what do I do? You know, making sure that there's a separation, making sure that there's no exposure under audit. So that's one of my biggest concerns. When I saw that, I thought, wow. You can't blame the provinces. They're looking at making sure that they can secure those revenues. But again, they do them, and sometimes I'm thinking they're doing them from their point of view, not realizing the complexity. We haven't had any clients audited for these platforms yet or these issues. But when those audits do come up, I'm sure we'll be hearing some cases, some issues, and some concerns that we're going to have to get ready to support our clients on, and to help them to understand how the legislation works. So that's a very interesting challenge that's ahead of us. But you know, hey, we're up for it.
Yeah, I do think it was an interesting measure. And it does have an effective date, I guess, July 1. So between now and then, I expect we'll see a little bit more detail on how the rules are going to work. I think you're right though. They've almost created a new taxable service for PST right. purposes in BC. We just don't know what the boundaries are, like what constitutes a market facilitation service or whatever they're going to call it. So that was interesting. The other thing I found interesting was they seem to be going full steam ahead if it involves, you know, supplies from within Canada to BC. But it looks like they're kind of waiting to see what they can do as far as collection of PST on sales where the goods are shipped from outside Canada into BC. And I wonder if that just comes down to enforcement or, you know, the potential legal ability to impose that tax. And I know there is a case working its way through the courts sort of challenging the province's authority to potentially collect PST or impose PST collection requirements on non-residents outside Canada when they might not have any assets in Canada, let alone British Columbia. So kind of interesting.
I would agree. Yeah. Well, and what my thought came to is the last measure that they put in place where they require non-residents of BC to be registered as, I think it was April last year, where they had sales over $10,000, right? So I think this kind of kind of operates in conjunction with that to say, listen, we're looking at sellers who are in Canada. We require them already to be registered if they are coming into making sales into BC once they hit 10,000. But now we have these marketplace facilitators where what's going to happen here? I didn't see any limits here. So now you've got marketplace facilitators maybe selling for small guys outside of Canada who are shipping goods into BC. There's no threshold amount. So they're saying once you ship on a platform that's delivering goods into BC, we want to make sure that you're actually accounting for the tax. So maybe, again, they're looking to make sure that all suppliers outside of BC or all supplies outside of BC are covered. And I would agree with you, too, that it's very challenging to require someone to be registered who's making a supply and there's no presence in Canada. That is a huge, huge challenge. So I'm thinking maybe BC's being cautious on there, working through that thought process before they put it into legislation somehow.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Jeff was right, though, in that this is a trend. Most of the jurisdictions are trying to impose these kinds of requirements and have been for quite some time. It just remains to be seen how effective they'll be. I know a lot of the larger suppliers, online marketplaces, are sort of voluntarily registering. So there has been some success. The question is, you know, will you really catch them all? I think BC was expecting this to increase provincial PST revenue by something like $100 million a year. So, you know, quite a bit of revenue at stake. Another interesting change BC has introduced, and it was kind of buried a little bit in some technical amendments, but there was a significant change in how they're going to treat PST on certain types of real property contracts. And Jeff, I know you have some experience with that issue.
Yeah, arguably the biggest change in the budget was a one-liner technical amendment that that a number of people were waiting for. The province had kind of tipped things off maybe about a month before the budget. They issued a notice that they were holding back on refunds related to real property claims, and this all stems from a case that the province lost in the British Columbia Supreme Court, I believe it was back in the fall in November. It was dealing with real property and it was a particular angle. You have to understand in British Columbia, the general way that tax applies to real property is that the person that's buying the real property or the improvement to real property doesn't pay the tax, but it's the contractor that pays the tax on the inputs and the supplies that they use to complete the contract. When British Columbia reintroduced the PST, they added another way that tax can be collected, and that's that the two parties, the contractor and the purchaser, can make an agreement that says that the purchaser will pay the PST, and now the contractor can buy the items exempt of tax because they're gonna charge the tax on the end sale, and there's requirements in there that, you know, so that there isn't monkey business going on with the prices, that in the agreement the actual prices of the items have to be stipulated, and there has to be a clause in there that states, you know, specifically that the customer is going to pay the PST. And that was the focus of the court case, was the contract said that the customer will pay the PST, but the province said, no, that's not good enough. We want it to say that they paid the PST under Section 80, 80.3 or 80.6 of the Provincial Sales Tax Act. And what was the point of the case was the judge said, well, I think you're just trying to split hairs on that one. If I'm a taxpayer, you know, I don't know what section it's paid out of generally. It's PST. And so me acknowledging that I'm going to pay PST is good enough. And the province didn't like that. And so they put all refund claims on real property contracts on hold. And while they studied the case, and they also made mention in their notice that you know, they didn't agree with it and they were going to change the rules retroactively to make sure that there had to be a writing of the tax sections in particular, and that's what they did. And now, interestingly enough, I haven't seen what the legislation says, but now there's this requirement not only to stipulate, you know, what goods are being sold, But also that the, you know, that the customer is going to pay tax under section 80, 80.3 and 80.6. I don't really don't see any change to the way the legislation was written. And I still think that the judge's kind of position or comments on it really haven't changed. You know, as a taxpayer, I don't really care what tax it is. It's the same rate. It's the same amount I'm paying. Why do I have to stipulate the amount? I don't know what that is. So they're splitting hairs here. And I think the biggest danger here is there's an opportunity for British Columbia to collect the tax twice on real property transactions. And how does that happen? Well, we enter into an agreement with a real property contractor, and the two parties agree that the customer is going to pay the tax, and we don't write it down specifically that they're paying tax under section 80, 80.3 or 80.6. The contractor still collects the tax and remits it. So now the government's got it once. Now the government auditor comes around and looks at the documentation and doesn't see that reference, and they go, well, no, that wasn't the alternative method. So we're going to assess you, real property contractor, on the value of the inputs into the real property contract. And now they got the tax the second time. And what's the likelihood that that contractor is actually going to go back to his customer and say, hey, you should get a refund for it? And in addition to that, depending on how long it took for the assessment to come, there is the potential that the time limits to actually get that refund expire, you know, if it's a 4-year audit. And so I think there's a serious potential for double collection of tax. And, you know, I don't know why British Columbia introduced this alternative method if they really wanted the contractor to collect the tax. And that's kind of what it looks like to me. So, you know, not a lot of time was spent on it. There's not a lot of information on it, but maybe the most significant change. And so, you know, I think our clients need to understand that currently there's a significant volume of refund claims related to real property contracts that that are on hold. And there's a good likelihood if they fit into this alternative method of collecting tax, the refund's going to be denied. And I guess the other part that I really don't like, it's kind of been a bugaboo for me even before I started practicing sales tax, is making retroactive changes. This change is retroactive to April 1st, 2013, which was the start time of PST after they kind of kicked harmonization aside. And I really don't like retroactive changes. It smells of sour grapes. And I don't want to play anymore, and I'm picking up the ball and leaving.
it does seem like they're looking to change the rules to fit how they think the game should be played. Certainly that court case had an impact on what they're trying to clarify there. I agree with you, though, and nothing upsets a tax practitioner more than retroactive legislation or the potential for double taxation. And this has both elements. Yep. Of both in this a potential change. So very interesting. I noticed also a couple of interesting changes, smaller measures, but interesting changes related to, I guess you'd call them green initiatives, or, you know, initiatives designed to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Can you comment on those a little bit?
Yeah, kind of, you know, it there's two of them, well, maybe three, but two of them from a PST perspective. And they have two pronged approaches to it. So the first one is zero emission vehicles. You know, they're going to make them resale ones. So a sale of used zero emission vehicles will no longer be subject to PST. That's, you know, categorically if it's sold by an automobile dealer. But it also applies to private sales. The one condition is that the vehicle has to have been used for at least 6,000 kilometers. And I guess the fear is that someone buys it and then turns around and flips it right away, and all of a sudden there's no tax on it anymore. So they want to make sure there's some driving on it. But, you know, on the other side of it, you know, to encourage the use of these vehicles. They're also making some adjustments to the surtax, and that's kind of the, you know, kind of the luxury angle to zero emission vehicles is that with automobiles, British Columbia says it's 7% PST until the price of the vehicle hits 55,000. And then at various stages, all the way up to $150,000 in value of the car, the sales tax increases. And so they've decoupled the zero emission vehicle surcharges from a regular standard vehicle. And so with these zero emission vehicles, the surcharge won't kick in until the vehicle's price hits $75,000. The ending amount, $150,000, still remains the same for both zero emission and a regular car. But you know, I think this really is important because it reflects the fact that in general, the cost of a zero emission vehicle is well in excess of a regular car. And so, you know, people would be discouraged from purchasing these cars if they're automatically going to have to pay the surcharge. And I think that's what it does. And this is in line with British Columbia. One thing that comes to mind when I think of British Columbia is, you know, a conscience for environmental friendliness. And this fits in line with it. You know, they want people to drive around in electric and zero emission vehicles. They don't want gas guzzlers. They don't want me coming there with my pickup truck and trailer because I'm spewing out all this carbon.
It does sound like good news if you're shopping for a Tesla in Vancouver, I have to say.
Yep.
And you're right. They do tend to be the leaders in those types of measures. Obviously, the first jurisdiction to bring in a carbon tax, right, in Canada. So,
yep.
I was going to jump in and say that with the gas prices here in Ontario, I don't know what the gas prices are in BC, but that would be a great incentive to go buy an electric vehicle right now.
Yeah, I think the price of oil is a greater incentive than the tax measure. But yeah,
you're
true.
It's over two in BC right now, and it's one six seven in Alberta right now. So we're producing it, and we're still going.
Just saw the fuel in Ontario, it was 164, so we're actually cheaper than Alberta.
Yeah, I think
let's mark that on the calendar, guys.
I think they've got us conditioned to believe when it's below $1.75 a liter, it's a good deal now.
Exactly.
It wasn't just that, though, Jeff. I guess they had another interesting measure, and this one has a little bit of the carrot and the stick approach.
Yeah, so they would like people to heat and air condition their home with heat pumps, which don't use fossil fuels or regular oil and gas. And so by doing that, they're going to effective April 1st, exempt the sale of heat pumps, and that's important. So that's the carrot. You know, if I buy a heat pump to heat and cool my house or building, I'm not going to pay PST on it. Now you still have the choice, and I would think that there's still a lot of people out there that heat and cool their home using a forced air furnace or a regular air conditioner, and if you buy a new forced air furnace or an air conditioner, you're now going to pay an increased amount of tax. Again, effective April 1st, 2022, the PST on those will be 12% rather than the regular 7%. So, you know, if you want to continue with your old ways and use your old traditional forced air furnace and regular air conditioner, you're going to pay more tax if you have to buy a new unit. And so there's the stick. Fine, if you choose not to use the heat pump, you're going to pay more tax. And you know, I think it makes sense. It's a way to get people to convert. I guess my only question is, you know, I think the conversion is likely to be pretty expensive. So you know, how many people will jump on the heat pump bandwagon? I would think if you got a new build, it's probably a no-brainer to go the heat pump route. But if you're looking to replace things, I'm not sure, and I'm not an expert in heating and air conditioning, but I don't know how easy it is to convert over from one to the other without extra cost. So it's interesting, and it does fit right in with British Columbia's plan to be environmentally conscious.
Yeah, and I guess if you're in that business, you do need to be aware of this little transitional rule in and around the announcement date as far as which rate of tax will apply to the fossil fuel heating equipment, right?
Yeah. Yeah, there's some opportunities. Like if you bought the heat pump, if you entered into the agreement before the budget day, even if it was installed afterwards, I believe that the I'm mixing it up with the air conditioner and furnace. If you entered into the agreement before the budget day and it's installed even after April 1st, I believe it'll be the 7% PST rate. But you know, after that, you're going to be paying the higher rate of tax. So there was some opportunities. If you entered into a deal before the budget announcement, that makes sense. You shouldn't be penalized because you may have made a different decision had you known that it was a higher rate of tax. Although I'm not one that believes that tax influences decision making, but that's another story for another day.
Fair enough. I noticed it didn't stop there. There's also kind of a interesting little exemption for hydrogen, a fuel tax exemption for hydrogen.
Yeah, and this is under the motor fuel tax, but they have a category one alternative fuel. And they've now, as of February 23rd, 22, decided that hydrogen is an alternative fuel. And what that means is that if you're classified as a category one alternative fuel, it's not subject to the motor fuel tax. Now, there are some conditions. First of all, it has to be purchased for use in an internal combustion engine. And the hydrogen fuel cannot be created using electrolysis from a coal-generated electricity process, unless the carbon dioxide emitted is during the process is captured or stored and isolated. There's some conditions on it, but if you're using hydrogen fuel in a motor vehicle, you're likely to be able to get that exemptive tax now. And I think the theory is that really the burning of hydrogen fuel is not creating carbon unless it was created by a coal generating electricity plant. And so it should be exemptive tax based on the philosophy that British Columbia is going to focus on environmental friendliness.
It's interesting in that it's like an oddly specific measure. I almost wonder if there's a specific type of vehicle they have in mind that burns hydrogen in an internal combustion engine. I mean, there must be some out there, but certainly not many people filling up their cars with hydrogen right now.
Yeah, and they left it as well, maybe a little bit more interesting, or maybe not more interesting, but interesting is they kind of left a comment out there that may not be a permanent change. They'll look at that depending on what the market share of hydrogen is. So, I kind of read that as, well, maybe if more people are turning to hydrogen, all of a sudden they're going to change their mind and begin to tax it. And they kind of said, it's subject to periodic review. So that may not be a permanent change, but hopefully it's around for a while.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, it wouldn't be a provincial budget if there wasn't some kind of adjustment to tobacco tax. So maybe for the last topic today, we'll talk a little bit about that change.
Okay. So tobacco was, taxed under the Tobacco Tax Act. And, usually a consistent theme in budgets is they increase the rate on tax on tobacco. They didn't do that here. There's been a kind of a longstanding exemption from provincial sales tax to tobacco products, and that's fairly common. If a product is taxed under one particular tax act, like the Tobacco Tax Act or the motor vehicle fuel tax, it's typically exempt from the provincial sales tax because otherwise you would have tax on tax. well, now they've come along and British Columbia said, we're eliminating the exemption from PST for tobacco products. And that will be effective July 1st, 2022. And, you know, they're basically saying, okay, we're going to double tax tobacco products, and we're going to use that money to help fund healthcare or address the cost of healthcare that smoking or using tobacco creates. And so, you know, I guess they're basically saying, hey, look, if you get sick by tobacco, then this tax is going to help you get better from it. I guess the problem I have is statements like that, you know, okay, this is going to address or help offset healthcare costs, is where's the checks and balances? Is, you know, I don't see that they're setting up a special fund for this PST on tobacco products that's going to go directly to the hospitals. My experience is these things go directly to the general funds, and so there is no correlation, but that's a justification for adding the tax. So there's no doubt that there's going to be an increase in the cost of tobacco. It's just not through the usual means, which is an increase to the tobacco tax rate.
And I totally agree with you there, Jeff, because it's interesting how they put the legislation in, and on the surface to the actual reader of the budget, oh, that's great, that's a great idea. But again, as you said, where is that correlation? What's the research study? I mean, at the end of the day, my question is, from all the other efforts they put in for tobacco, what have they been seeing as far as tobacco sales? Is it the sales are going really high, they want to capture the tax, or they're not getting enough revenue from tobacco, so they want to now capture the tax? Which one is it? But either way, I'm totally with you that, you know, we do see this a lot when it comes to a lot of government policies and legislations. They put that smoke screen up and say, well, here's what we're going to do. And we would hope that a couple of years down the road, we actually see that. So let's cross our fingers. Maybe they're right this time. Let's see what happens.
I think you guys make a great point. I mean, very often you see tobacco tax increases. That's not what BC did here. They're actually saying, we'll leave tobacco taxes alone. We're just going to make it subject to PST now too, and double tax it. But we see these increases year after year. It's always the same reasoning is, you know, this is to discourage people from smoking, and, you know, it'll help, you know, the health of our residents. But where are the results? You know, I mean, at what point does raising the cost not, you know, is it not effective in changing public opinion? Like you said earlier, Jeff, sometimes you can only do so much with sales tax measures to influence behavior.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there's going to be someone that now has to pay PST that goes, okay, that's it. I'm not using cigarettes anymore. I think that's going to be a very small percentage. I mean, you know, unfortunately, the people that smoke, they're addicted to it. You know, it's an illness in itself. And I don't think it really matters how much they pay for it. They're going to continue to do it because, you know, they've got this need for nicotine. And I think there's other ways, and I'm sure BC has other programs that help address that part of it from the health side. But I think those is where the money should be spent. And, you know, maybe there should have been something in here that says, hey, you know, we're creating this specific fund to help people who have the addiction to tobacco or whatever the case. I don't see that here. I just say, oh, you know, it's going to offset healthcare costs.
Isn't this exactly in true BC style? What happened with the tax on soda pops?
Yeah, they said the same thing. You know, you know, we don't want you to get diabetes or become overweight, so we're going to tax soda products. And I don't think anyone can argue with the argument or disagree with the argument. It's just, I don't know. Did anyone stop buying soda products?
I don't think so.
My kids still drink way too much soda, so exactly. I'm not sure. I'm not sure it was effective from that standpoint.
And I think the slippery slope on that one is, you know, taxing soda products. And we're kind of going back into last year's budget, but the slippery slope is, you know, the province is now kind of infringed on
an area where there's never been taxed before, and that's on food in British Columbia. And, you know, is this give them, you know, the thin edge of the wedge to get in and start taxing some more food products, maybe in restaurants?
Exactly. That's my focus is going to. I agree with you.
And that was the big, you know, one of the biggest reasons why the HST had to go in British Columbia was, hey, you're taxing food, which wasn't taxed before. And I, you know, time will tell on that one, whether this is just an isolated thing or whether it's going to be the start of a broader attempt to try and tax food products. May not be all, you know, it may be just in restaurants and things like that. But that would certainly be a significant boost in revenue, I would think, especially with the tourism market in British Columbia.
And it wouldn't be hard to do, just bring them in line with all the other provinces, right? So, yeah.
Well, that's a great discussion, but we'll have to leave it there. Michelle, Jeff, Carol, thank you very much for your insights.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, everyone.
Certainly welcome.
Thanks, Jim. Thanks, everyone.
That concludes this episode of Ryan Talks Tax. For information on all the provincial budget announcements, check out our news and insights page at ryan.com/Canada. And please let us know what you think about the podcast. You can send your questions, comments, or suggestions to webinars@ryan.com. Thanks for listening.